I'm going to test the microphone a little bit. Am I on? Nope. Here we come. Keep talking. I'm talking. I'm happy to be here this Sunday morning. This is my first time as convener, so you all need to be patient with me as I figure this out. Hello. Hello, hello. There I am. Good morning. Happy Sunday. It's a beautiful day. I woke up this morning in Lyons, Kansas. I went to a wedding last night for a friend. It was the joining of two families. They involved their kids in the ceremony. It was beautiful. I cried like a baby. Had a really good time afterwards and got to visit with a long-lost kind of friend who's had quite the adventure the past couple years. So this service this morning is in no danger of being over-rehearsed because I was... Thank you for laughing. I was out of town until about 35 minutes ago. Okay. Thank you all for being here today. For the kids that are in my Sunday school classes, you are to stay in here with me today. So if I see Lily, and I don't know if I see anybody else, but anybody who's in grades 6 through 8 should stay in here today because I would like you to hear what I have to say. For those of you that are visiting, you are welcome here. For those of you that are members, you are welcome here. No matter what you believe, no matter who you love, you are welcome here. I bring your attention to some announcements, both the insert and the calendar of events that are coming up soon. And I had two additional announcements to share with everyone today. And those are from the Committee on Ministry. With the support of the Board of Directors, would like to continue the UFM ministry assessment by inviting anyone to offer written input at this time. You may send an email or mail a letter to one of our assessment teams, I'm going to name them in a minute, so that it arrives by Wednesday, October 17th. All comments will be received and handled confidentially. Your input is appreciated as a helpful contribution to the ministry at UUFM. To obtain email and postal addresses, contact a team member, Pat Embers, who is in California today, but Mark Moser, Laura Bonella, or Kathy Hedge. And I see Kathy here at least. So if you have questions about where to send your written comments, please visit with Kathy today. This information is also in the UUFM newsletter. It's been sent to the listserv as well as our website. So all comments are welcome. All right. Now we have time for joys and concerns and any introduction of visitors, if you like. Oh, I'm sorry. Jim. Jim had another announcement. Following our first highly successful fellowship dinner, formerly called the Circle Dinner, in September, a second dinner for the fall will be on Friday, October 12th. Old and especially new UUs are invited to join in good food and convivial conversation. The host or hostess is to be announced, will be responsible for providing a place to eat and coordinating who brings what to these potluck dinners. There is a sign-up sheet on the bulletin board in the narthex. For further information, you can contact Jim Chanteau or Ann Marchin. All right, joys and concerns. I saw a hand at the back of the room.
Yvonne Lacey. As of next week, the end of the week, I shall be moving to Boulder, Colorado, to a retirement center where my daughter lives in Boulder, and I have a son in Fort Collins, where I'm hoping that Sam will soon join me. My sadness is leaving this family, which I love, one and all of you, and I have been 40-odd years in this community and in this family, and thank you all so very much.
I'm Elke Lorenz, and I would like to introduce to you my very wiggly 13-month-old granddaughter, Sophie, who is with me today.
Jim Chanteau. think I was the last person here to see Steve and Marilyn leave on Friday as they pulled out in a caravan, literally, a large truck pulling a large trailer with a van pulling a small trailer. They made it as far as Panera's, they said, when the some kind of a problem with the truck and large trailer, apparently the hitch came off. And so they spent the night at the Clarion Friday night, left yesterday, made it to just outside of St. Louis. So it appears that the Stephen Marilyn adventure continues. By the way, the last I saw their driveway, it was piled with stuff to be taken out to the dumpsters and whatnot. It was quite an adventure seeing them off, but sadly, they are now gone.
Betty Banner, I'd just like to say it's a great day to be alive. And thanks to all for your cards and greetings and wishes from condolences to get well. Thank you.
I think I don't see them here this morning, but I think we need to thank Stacy and Tom for these lovely flowers. These adorned the sanctuary yesterday for their wedding, which was also a joining of two families. It was very lovely.
Yes, I did not do this. Oh, Sandy just told me I match with the purple. Anybody else? Okay, well, thank you all. I love stories, and we're going to wait on the lighting of the chalice. Don't think I've forgotten. That's going to be part of the children's story, actually, today. But I love stories, and I love understanding how things began, and that's my inspiration for doing this talk today. So I love stories about how things began, and I'd like to sing. So our first hymn for today is about the beginnings of freedom for two people, the exodus of the children of Israel and the African Americans who were striving for an end to slavery. Open your hymns to number 104 and stand as you are able to join me in singing When Israel Was in Egypt's Land.
When Israel was in Egypt's land, let my people go. Oppressed to the farm they could not stand, let my people go.
I may have mentioned that I love stories, and I love understanding how things began. Amy has agreed to read one of the books I discovered when Nick was small. It's an Aztec creation tale called Musicians of the Sun, and its topic leads to this being the reading for our chalice lighting today. So if Amy and the kids would come up for a story.
Can you hear me, everyone? That doesn't sound like it's on. Is it on?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, I am going to read Musicians of the Sun. Out of the starry night he came, invisible, untouchable. Lord of the night, king of the gods, soul of the world. Lord of the night had a magic mirror. It was his third eye. In it, he could see all the earth. The world is gray and joyless, he said. Children do not laugh. Women do not dance. Men do not sing. The people spend their lives in darkness and silence. I will change this, he declared. Lord of the night called wind to his side. O wind, he said, fly to the house of the sun. Free the four musicians held prisoner there, red, yellow, blue, and green. Bring them to the earth so the people may hear their music. But Lord, said the wind, sun is a mighty warrior who destroys his enemies with fire. I am nothing but air. How will I overcome his power? Do not be afraid, said the Lord of the Night. I will arm you. Lord of the Night gave Wind a turquoise shield, a black thundercloud, and a shining silver lightning. Wind took the weapons and swept across the mountains, searching for the house of the sun. At last he reached the edge of the sea. He met Turtle Woman, Fish Woman, and Alligator Woman on the shore. Where is the house of the sun? Asked Wind. On the other side of the sea, answered Turtle Woman, too far for wind to blow. It is a long journey over waves and through darkness, said Fish Woman. Your strength will fail. But Lord of the Night has sent me, said Wind. I must free the prisoners of the sun. We will help you, said Alligator Woman. Turtle Woman, Fish Woman, and Alligator Woman carried Wind far across the sea. The sky began to glow. Faster, cried Wind, before sun rises too high. The three women swam until the sea foamed white behind them. Now sun was shining above the horizon. Wind took a great breath and leapt into the sky. As he flew up toward the house of the sun, he heard the sweet music of flute, drum, shell, and rattle. Musicians of the sun, called Wind, I am coming to free you. The musicians heard the voice of Wind. They yearned to be free, but sun made them more fearful. They continued to play. Go away, said sun to Wind, or I will destroy you. Wind went closer still and called out again, Musicians of the sun, come with me. Ignore him, said sun. Play on. Sun burned more fiercely, and the musicians played louder than before. Wind came near. Musicians of the sun, I am here to take you down to earth. Come no closer, sun shouted. He hurled a rain of fire darts at Wind. Wind raised his turquoise shield and was not harmed. Then Wind howled and unleashed his thunder. Black clouds spilled forth. Darkness covered the face of the sun, and his light grew dim. The four musicians huddled together. "We are frightened, O wind," they cried. "Then come with me to earth," said Wind. "I promise you freedom." The musicians grasped Wind's cloak as he leapt away from the house of the sun. Wind threw his shining silver lightning to cut through the darkness below. "Come back," bellowed the sun. "I command you." But Sun was lost in the black clouds, and he was powerless. Wind carried the musicians through the sky, across the stars, and gently down to earth. Lord of the Night welcomed them. "Play your music," he said. "Bring happiness to my people." The musicians curled their toes in the cool earth and began to play. Red-faced East and played a song of joy on her drum. Yellow-faced West and played a lullaby on his flute. Blue-faced South and played a song of night on her shell. Green-faced North and played a song of dawn on his rattles. Wind carried the beautiful sounds around earth. The world filled with color. Children laughed, women danced, men sang. Even Sun was happy and poured out his light upon them. All gave thanks to Lord of the Night, King of the Gods, Soul of the World. The end.
Thank you, Amy. Mm-hmm. Thank you, kids, for listening so well. Is that a good story? All right, thank you. Okay,
go now in peace. Go now.
Just to keep the theme going, mentioning I love the stories. And for our offertory today, I'll share a story behind this song. It starts out a little bit strange, I apologize. But this is a song that my father used to play and sing to me that's about the joy of having a baby in your life. So, does anybody else here love Stevie Wonder? Is it just me? I got a couple hands. In reflecting on that for just a moment, think about today as I'm talking, what stories are your resources? What stories make you happy? What stories make you strong? Are they true stories of your life? True stories of someone else's life? Fictional heroes? Religious texts? Be thinking of that as I'm talking today, please. Only a few hundred years ago, the average person's access to stories was limited to the fireside at night or maybe a weekly religious service. The information age allows us to access stories and concepts by the thousands. We consume them quickly, alarmingly sometimes. Who can keep up with the influences impacting our mates, our friends, our children, and our community? In many ways, we are each free to form our own personalized culture. Today is a glimpse into the foundations of my personal culture in hopes that it will make you think about your influences and ways to share them too. I'm not here, which was when I was first writing this, I was tending to be too far in this direction. I'm not here to tell you about my favorite books or to make you love to read. That'll be your thing. You don't have to like the same books as me. You don't have to love to read. But to share with you about the importance of stories and characters to me. Scripture is defined in several ways, but the first definition is normally a sacred book or writing. Sacred has been described as whatever it is in a culture at which one cannot laugh. Somebody's giggling. Mantra is defined as an often repeated word, formula, phrase, or truism. These stories are sacred to me. I do not laugh at them. They have given me mantras that have served me well. Now, I don't think the authors are prophets. I am not trying to start a new cult or religion, believe you me. Don't have the energy for that. But if I could meet any one of these authors, I would say to them, thank you, your book changed me. I have taken extreme liberties with the text that Dave will be my lovely assistant reading today, and I've tried to cobble things together in a way to make you get a little sense of what the book and the scene and the setting is about, but also to make them more understandable and shorter. It's Some may be more successful than others. So Dave, thank you for being here. And he's putting on his best actor hat. And so there's 7 vignettes. 3 are from the same author. I'll introduce, Dave will read, and then I'll respond. So hopefully, time-wise, we'll be on the nose and have time for discussion afterwards. So, number 1. In 1958, a book by Mary Renault about ancient Greece was published. Reviews of The King Must Die almost always talk about its personal impact. One fellow fan, Joe Walton, says, "It's so engraved in my DNA that I am incapable of evaluating it sensibly." Renault's main character, a young boy, is at his grandfather's knee as the grandfather explains the role of a leader to him.
Long ago, our people lived in the Northland, beyond Olympus. Instead of water, they had a sea of grass. They lived by the increase of their herds. They built no cities. They saw a wide sky which draws men's mind to the gods, and they gave their first fruits to ever-living Zeus, who sends the rain. The folk followed their king Horus to the sea. Perhaps Zeus sent no rain, or people grew too many, or they were pressed by enemies. But it was with horses our folk took these lands from the shore people who were here before us. The horse will be the victor's sign as long as we remember. This was the place of our Moira. Moira? What is Moira? Moira is the finished shape of our fate, the line drawn around it. It is the task gods allot us, and the share of glory they allow, the limits we must not pass, our appointed end. Moira is all of these. Listen and do not forget, for I am telling you a mystery. The horse goes blindly to the sacrifice, but when a king is dedicated, he knows his Moira. He is choosing a short life with glory. In 3 years, or 7, or 9, it is not the sacrifice itself, whether it comes in youth or age, or the god remits it, it is not these that call down the power. It is the consenting, the readiness in all. It washes from the heart and mind things of no account and leaves them open to hear and to understand.
It is the consenting, the readiness in all. I grew up on a floodplain where the sky dominates, and it's really easy to feel like a moat. Imagine a barefoot girl blowing milkweed seeds and watching rain move across the horizon. You cannot think you are a great or powerful being on the plains. You know your place in the world, and nothing unravels when a moat stops moving. I am open to each day. My mother always told me, that I believed in fairness and justice deeply from a young age, but that in wanting those things, I also accepted reality. I cannot meditate. My mind races. But when I hear these 2 sentences together, my mind rests for at least a moment. It is the consenting, the readiness in all. Okay, number 2. In high school, I found a copy of Sons by Pearl S. Buck, which is actually a sequel to The Good Earth, so I read them out of order. But when I read The Good Earth, it struck a chord. Poetry in prose. I have reread this book yearly for nearly 25 years. Buck won the Pulitzer Prize for Literature in 1932 for the book. An Chi Minh, an expat from China, actually, she lives in both places now, didn't get to read Pearl S. Buck until she was in the U.S. because they don't particularly like the Westerner over there when An Chi Minh was growing up. She said when she read this book, she had never read any novelist who wrote with such admiration, affection, and humanity. My copy, torn cover and taped spine and falling apart, was printed in 1962 and cost 35 cents new. The main character, Wang Lung, is the son of a poor farmer in pre-revolutionary China. One day, Wang Lung's father tells him he has found him a wife. A rich woman in the town has decided to give a kitchen slave to a poor man in marriage. Wang Lung goes to town to pick up Olan and there is no real ceremony. As two strangers, but husband and wife, they leave the rich house together with a box. Olan walks behind.
And thus they went until they reached the western field where stood the temple to the earth. This temple was a small structure, not higher in all than a man's shoulder, and made of gray bricks and roofed with tile that Wang Long's grandfather, who had farmed the very fields upon which Wang Long now spent his life, had built it, hauling the bricks from the town upon his wheelbarrow. Within the temple, snugly under the roof, sat two small, solemn figures, earthen, for they were formed from the earth of the fields around the temple. Wang Lung took the incense he had bought and put two sticks in the ashes that were heaped before the gods, for the whole neighborhood worshipped these two small figures. Together, this man and this woman stood before the gods of their fields. The woman watched the ends of the incense redden and turn gray. When the ash grew heavy, she leaned over, and with her forefinger, she pushed the head of the ash away. And then, as though fearful for what she had done, she looked quickly at Wang Long. But there was something he liked about her movement. It was as though she felt that the incense belonged to them both. It was a moment of marriage. They stood there in complete silence, side by side, while the incense smoldered into ashes. And then, because the sun was sinking, Wang Lung shouldered the box, and they went home.
It was a moment of marriage. For those of you who have been married or in a long-term partnership, maybe yours is perfect, but mine is not. It's not bluebirds and tinkling bells. Somehow, from the very beginning of my relationship, I knew that marriage was building a life together. It was not finding someone who would take care of me or always agreeing on everything, and it was not about occasional grand gestures. It was about finding joy in a daily rhythm with a person that includes waking and eating and working and sleeping and respect and laughing when you can. The Good Earth is not a feel-good book, and it is most certainly not a romance, for those of you who are familiar with it. But it is the story of building a life. A marriage is not a wedding, but a series of moments. And every once in a while, when Rob and I are working together, preparing a meal, or getting through the week's laundry, or talking about the calendar, or working in the yard, and we're completely together, I think this is a moment of marriage. I believe a big part of my marital longevity is just stick-to-itiveness. I'm in this for the long haul, whether Rob likes it or not. And my rewards are those moments of marriage. It is the consenting, the readiness in all, a moment of marriage. Number three. To return to our characters, Olan, after doing much-needed domestic organization and rearranging, joins Wang Lung to work in the fields and says, "There's nothing left for me to do in the house until nightfall."
Wang Lung had no articulate thought of anything. There was only this perfect sympathy of movement, of turning this earth of theirs over and over to the sun, this earth which formed their home and fed their bodies and made their gods. The earth lay rich and dark and fell apart lightly under the points of their hoes. Sometime in some age, bodies of men and women had been buried there. Houses that stood there had fallen and gone back into the earth. So would also their house, sometime, return into the earth. Their bodies also. Each had his turn on this earth.
I do not believe in heaven. There are so many arguments you can get into when discussing that lack of belief. There are so many people to depress if they believe. But rather than getting into an argument or depressing people, Buck gave me the words to express it cleanly. I believe this is my turn at this earth. And just leave it at that. It is the consenting, the readiness in all, a moment of marriage. Each has his turn at this earth. Number four. Again, back to our story, and then we'll be done with this book, I think. Yeah. Again, back to our story. Three children came to the couple with another on the way, prosperity and joy. But then a year of terrible famine, and the family had to abandon their land. starving. They make their way to a large town where they camp in a hut against a city wall, eat from a rice kitchen bag, and Wang Lung tries to find work. One night, Wang Lung returns to the hut and finds O Lan cooking pork. He thinks she must have gotten lucky begging that day. But then his younger son says, "I took it. This is mine, this meat. When the butcher looked the other way, I ran under an old woman's arm and seized it and ran into an alley and hid."
"Now I will not eat this meat," cried Wang Lung angrily. "We will eat meat we can buy or beg, but not that which we steal. Beggars we may be, but thieves we are not." And he took the meat and he threw it upon the ground and was heedless of the younger lad's bellowing. Then O Lan came forward and she picked up the meat. She washed it off with a little water and thrust it back over the fire. "Meat is meat," she said quietly. Wang Lung said nothing then, but he was angry and afraid in his heart because his sons were growing into thieves in this city. He ate none of the meat himself, and when the meal was over, he took his younger son out of Olan's hearing, and there, behind a house, he took the boy's head under his arm and cuffed it soundly on this side and on that side, and he would not stop for all the lads bellowing. "There and there and there," he shouted, "that for a thief." But to himself he said, when he had let the lad go away sniveling, "We must go back to the land."
When I was 12, my parents divorced. 6 months later, my father was working on a truck in our garage. Gas can exploded, and he was burned over 90% of his body. Everyone thought he would die. We didn't know. Dad owned his own company, and my mother had no access to his finances and little money of her own. It was not a year of famine. We ate, but it was a year of scarcity. Our family became a charity case. Our friends and neighbors gave us money to pay the bills. A man in town who was really a big jerk came by one night and gave my mom some money so my brother could get new basketball shoes. Mom took the check. He needed shoes. Meat is meat. We were working poor with no safety net to handle an immediate crisis. In the short term, if we had not had that community, I don't know what we would have done. When I see a hurricane or a flood or a tornado, I think, the whole community is lost and neighbors can't help one another. And that's the tragedy. My father did survive, and after only a year on disability, returned to the workforce. But when I think of Olan saying, "Meat is meat," I know these decisions, these compromises are happening for families every day. I have never been ashamed of taking charity. But I don't know if my mother or brother or father felt differently. I hope they felt as Wang Lung did. Beggars we may be, but thieves we are not, and kept their pride. When I give to a charity or a person, I do not feel better than. I feel fortunate, as should we all. It is the consenting, the readiness in all, a moment of marriage. Each has his turn at this earth. Meat is meat, yet beggars we may be, thieves we are not. Number 5. In college, I read a lot of books as a history major, and I also took a lot of English. I read classic fiction during this time, but nothing stuck with me like Dune by Frank Herbert. Now is when I confess to my love of science fiction and dystopias and all kinds of stuff, but for our service today, I'm not going to delve too deeply into that because I don't think you'd hang with me. I read Dune when I was 19. It's a difficult universe to grasp. There are, of course, like any good stories, good guys and bad guys, and the good guys act bad, and the women are so powerful and intriguing. There's a group called the Bene Gesserit. Listen closely. They manage religions without seeming to have one as their own. They have the ability to become reverend mothers by drinking a poison, which, if they survive, awakens in them genetic memories of their female line. This access to memories gives them wisdom, but it also separates them from the rest of humanity. Their focus on the long view, the survival of mankind, makes them seem callous at best, vicious at worst, and they say things like this.
You've heard of animals chewing off their legs to escape a trap. That's an animal kind of trick. A human would remain in the trap, endure the pain, feigning death, so that he might kill the trapper and remove a threat to his kind.
Isn't that lovely? Not the kind of thing we normally talk about here. One reviewer of Dune says, "Dune is in so many ways a journey of the mind. Some of the most fascinating moments of the novel come from a character's relaxed meditation. The action in the novel, including the violence, is perfectly warranted and doesn't get in the way of the, story in a gratuitous way," and I would agree. Herbert's characters face these challenges that require bravery, daring, and enduring physical pain. And at one point, a character who is trying to do something difficult says,
"Pain is a function of nerves. Pain comes as light comes to the eyes. Effort comes from the muscles, not the nerves."
After my mom was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, she had a massive surgery to remove her entire pancreas and a lot of other surrounding organs and tissues. In the ICU, there was a lot of trouble with pain management. She was restless and moaning and trying to move when she shouldn't move and saying she hurt, and we were really unsure if the pain was real or if the drugs were working or if she wasn't lucid. It was going on, and I remember my brother looking so helpless, and then I started talking to her, and I said, "Mom, I read a book once, and there was a saying, pain is a function of nerves, and it's a way of thinking about your body. Your nerves are telling your brain that your body is hurting. Stay in your brain and think a bit. Your body is in a lot of pain, but your medicine should be helping. Tell your body you know it's hurting. I did this when I broke my leg, and it worked. Stay in your brain and say to yourself, pain is a function of nerves. Pain is a function of nerves." And as I talked, she calmed down. Maybe it was just my voice. Maybe the medication was kicking in. Maybe it really was the words. I quoted a book that I'd read 20 years before that she, who had never loved science fiction or had any patience with it, had ever experienced. And it brought me strength and it brought her comfort. And we'll never forget feeling useful in that moment. I don't know if we're made of just this stuff, bodies. But that was one of the rare moments when I felt we might be made of more. It is the consenting, the readiness and all, a moment of marriage. Each has his turn at this earth. Meat is meat, yet beggars we may be, but thieves we are not. Pain is a function of nerves. Number 6. One reviewer, Trevor Carney, says that the beauty of historical fiction is in presenting multiple perspectives. It can present complex issues in multidimensional ways, helping us see things for the first time. I'm going to make an offhand comment and then I'll bring it back. I will say that when you wait a long time to have children, you are susceptible to fall in love with them. Colleen McCullough writes these fantastic characters, and in The Grass Crown, I met her Aurelia shortly before I had Nick.
Baby Gaius Julius was a special case, and a very difficult one. Even the capable Aurelia felt the breath of some unknown menace upon the back of her neck whenever she stopped long enough to think about this only son, about his qualities and his future. On one level, his brilliance thrilled her, inspired her with all kinds of dreams for his future. But on most levels, he depressed her deeply. Had she known his weaknesses and his flaws, she would have coped with him more easily. But who, even a mother, could possibly know the innate character weaknesses and flaws of a child not yet 2 years old? Yet, how ridiculous, such heart searchings on behalf of a baby. Just because the mental processes were huge did not mean the experience matched it. For the moment, young Gaius was simply a sponge, soaking up whatever he found fluid enough to sink in. There were weaknesses and flaws, but his mother did not know whether they were permanent or merely the passing phases of an enormous learning process. He was, for instance, utterly charming. He knew it and played upon it and meant people to his will. She didn't want to raise a child who relied upon such dark techniques as charm. Aurelia herself had no charm at all, and she despised those who had it, for she had seen how easily they got what they wanted and how little they valued it once they had it. Charm was the mark of a lightweight, not a leader of men. Young Gaius would have to abandon it, for it would do him no good with those men in the areas where seriousness and virtue mattered most. As a result of all this worry, nothing but time would answer. She had got into the habit of being hard on the little boy, of finding far less excuse for his mistakes, of rubbing salt into his wounds instead of balm, of being quick to criticize or scold him. As everyone else made much of him and downright spoiled him, his mother felt someone had to play the role of nasty stepsister. If it had to be her, his mother, so be it.
I am drawn to this character and this dilemma plainly and literally. Like Aurelia, I do believe charm is the mark of a lightweight, and I have none myself. It's the weaknesses and flaws line that catches me in that passage. When Nick was around 2, he played nonstop with an alphabet animal set, so 26 animal figures, each for a letter of the alphabet. And they went all over our house and left our house and everything else. And he'd be in the middle of all this chaos, and he'd say, "Where's the flamingo?" And we'd count, and sure enough, all 25 would be there with one missing, the flamingo, and he would notice it. And we were like, "Is that cool? Is that weird? What is that?" He's always been bright and verbal and everything else. And when he was 4, I watched him successfully negotiate his way out of doing anything asked of him at swim lessons day after day after day. And I thought, "Houston, we have a problem." And I decided that I must address this deliberately by talking about the qualities that are important to Rob and I, and more by putting him in situations where we can see what choices he makes. How else will I know what is a passing phase? What kind of man he will be? I am determined to not be a hovering parent, offering too much guidance or expect perfection out of this only son. But I do hope one day to look at a man who is caring and kind and hardworking and happy. And if I ignored the weaknesses and flaws, I think there would be less chance of that. It is the consenting, the readiness in all, a moment of marriage. Each has his turn at this earth. Meat is meat, yet beggars we may be, but thieves we are not. Pain is a function of nerves. There are weaknesses and flaws. Okay. 7. Also from Colleen McCullough's Master of Rome series, she describes religious festivals throughout and rituals after exhaustive research, but brings them to life.
Bonadia was the good goddess, as old as Rome herself, and therefore owning neither face nor form. She was Numen. She did have a name, but it was never uttered, so holy was it. What she meant to Roman women, no man could understand. The Vestal Virgins cared for her because she had no priestesses of her own. On May Day, the women of Rome woke their good goddess from her winter sleep amid flowers and festivities held in and around her temple. Roman citizen women from all walks of life flocked to attend the mysteries, which began at dawn and were ended by dusk. The exquisitely balanced duality of the good goddess was manifest in May birth and rye death, in wine and in milk, the eternal female cycle of birth and death. Then, at the beginning of December, Bonadea went back to sleep, but not publicly. Because what she dreamed in winter was her secret. The rites were open to only the highest born of Roman women. All her daughters might witness her resurrection, but only the daughters of kings might watch her die. Death is sacred. Death is private.
As I attended my mother in her last days, I did feel privileged, perhaps not like the daughter of a king. But a year before, Mom had wanted to be surrounded by friends. A week before, circled by the close ones. Honestly, she took her first dose of morphine and then called 10 people to come over and listen to music on the patio. But in the final days, she only wanted to have her daughters and her beloved hospice nurse, Mari. I was alone with her at the end. Death is sacred. Death is private. I dare not share anymore. It is the consenting, the readiness in all, a moment of marriage. Each has his turn at this earth. Meat is meat, yet beggars we may be, but thieves we are not. Pain is a function of nerves. There are weaknesses and flaws. Death is sacred. Death is private. Okay. That resolves my sharing of the books and passages that are helpful to me. And let's give Dave a round of applause, because he was channeling his female side on that last bit. Good channeling of the female. So if anyone has a story, a book that's been meaningful to them, questions to me, please bring it up. Because we have time. We went faster than I thought.
Hi, I'm Kathy Hedge, and an English teacher, so my gosh, there's a huge, long list, and I thank you very much, Molly. This was really very, very touching. As you were reading and sharing all of these beautiful pieces, it reminded me of, I'm sorry, I can't remember the doctor's name, but he came and spoke to us in Junction City and was really talking about the children of poverty and how to get them to read, how to be interested in reading. And he worked specifically with young men in what for this particular part of research. And but what he said is one of the greatest tragedies of our poor is when he would interview these young men, I think they were like 15, 16 years old, and one of the things he would do was ask them to list books or writings of any kind that had a huge impact on their lives. And their pages were blank. They didn't have access to literature that was meaningful to them in their grade school. Much of it had been fiction that was didn't make them feel anything. So one of his main things that he did was to work with these young people to read bits of literature that he thought would have an impact, and that most were non-readers, many who could not read, and he would do it orally with them. He would, for example, he put Raisin in the Sun up on the overhead, and they'd all read it together like 10 times over a span of days and talk about it until the boys could read it on their own, even though they couldn't read anything else. Mm-hmm. And the impact of what they were able to then talk about, and not just, they weren't just, you know, brainwashed, but they were given this world that they had not seen before. They were given these phrases that they could put in their hearts And when they were desperate, they could pull those phrases out. And those books became part of books or documents became part of their lives. And he said it was an incredibly powerful thing. And after that, the young men became readers because they discovered exactly what you shared with us today about how that fiction builds our own inner self.
Thank you.
Thank you, Molly. We have a book club in this fellowship that would be happy for you to join us, and I'm sure we'll be going over some of these books that we need to read again if we have read them. And also, in the same vein, if you want to throw away some of your books, we're going to have a book sale this fall. I don't know when.
Recycle.
Starting, I think, in about the third grade in my school, I had to read four and report on four books a year, and half of them had to be fiction, which was torture for me. I hated it. I could read a historical character or a sports hero or something, but the fiction books were... In fact, I just read a little bit and then copied that on the report. It was intellectual dishonesty at an early age.
Don't do that, Lily.
Then when I got to junior high, it was six books a year, so now it's three of the damn things that I had to read. And in ninth grade, when I was 15, one of those books was The Human Comedy by William Saroyan. And it changed my life because the hero of the story was ashamed of thoughts he had about family and himself and the world and wouldn't share them with anybody. And they were exactly the same thoughts I had had, and it was such a relief to find out that I was not alone in my bad state and bad ideas. And it changed me in that respect. It still was hard to read fiction, but I got better at it because I hoped I might find, and I did. I can't tell you about this one because it's just too awful, but I read a book as a senior about a person who was in a bad situation, which mirrored mine, and it was eye-opening.
Several things. Your presentation was very rich in suggestions. The first thing that suggested anything to me was viewing the cover of the book, the Pearl Buck. A book is not only an association of our personal involvements with it, our intellectual involvements with it, but it's also an artifact. And as much as I love my Kindle, my iPad, all my other electronics, and that will be the way I go for the most part, I do appreciate the cover of a book. It becomes a physical presence, a visual enhancement to the decor of any home. And when I go to visit a friend's home, I'm always happy or distressed, alternately, to find that they have the same editions of those books. Okay. Secondly, your presentation suggests to me that there is a bit of dogma that we Unitarians adhere to, and that is a book lent is a gift. Sometimes you never see them come back. And I haven't reached the stage of emotional development yet where I can be totally generous about that. I'm sort of balanced between generosity and resentment when I don't get a book back. Finally, I appreciate the emotional depth and the intellectual honesty with which you approach the topic today. Very well done.
Thank you.
Yeah, I too. I'm Christopher Renner, and I agree, Molly. This has been excellent. I've sat back here thinking about all sorts of books I've read in my life. Recently, I had some students over for dinner, and we got talking about reading books. And one of the things I said is I used to read most of my books on public transportation in Italy. And I would say on average, in the 17 years I was in Italy, I read 100 books a year. Here in the United States, I'm lucky if I can get through three. Because I don't have that time of just sitting on a public piece of transportation and having the joy of having 30 minutes to read. I'm usually behind a steering wheel. And my students and I got talking about what really upset me was one of my students, who's a, I think now a junior at K-State, says he hadn't read 200 books in his whole life. And I said, what are you waiting for? And he just looked at me and he said, well, what are some good books? And so I really wonder what we're doing in our high school English classes, you know, sometimes. So I started listing off things that have changed my life. And the first and foremost, unfortunately, is a piece of philosophy by J. Krishnamurti in his book, The Awakening of Intelligence. And I've talked about this book here in this fellowship probably 12 years ago or 11 years ago, and the idea of the sacred and how J. Krishnamurti talks about how you can put a rock on your on the mantle of a fireplace, and if you bring it flowers and say prayers to it every day, in a month, that rock will be sacred, but it's still just a rock. And I think so much, when I look out on our society today, we have such big sacred cows walking around, but they're just cows. And for some reason, as a society, we don't stop and think about that. Another book that really changed my life and changed how I saw life was The Mists of Avalon. That was back in the early 80s. It's a feminist historical fiction novel about the King Arthur myth, told from a feminist point of view, the point of view of Gwendolyn, who was a witch in the pagan Celtic tradition. And I gave that book, because it had been translated into Italian, to Italian female friends of mine. And several of them came up to me and said, I can't finish this book, because if I finish reading this book, it's going to totally change how I see society. I never knew that the church came in and imposed this structure, and that women were told that they have to do this. I didn't know women could have positions of power. And I said, in the pagan cultures, they could. They were the font of knowledge. The mystery of childbirth was sacred. Another book that I really like, and I would encourage anybody to read, are the short stories by Eudora Welty. Her ability in the last sentence of a story to turn it on its head and throw you totally off balance is something that I think we in the United States need more of. We become so entrenched in making sure that we know all the answers to things. But Eudora, in her way of writing, in that last sentence of every story, she'd put every perceived thought you had about how that story was going to end right on its head. And sometimes I think as a culture we need that.
I'll do an additional comment to Christopher's. I haven't read Mists of Avalon. I actually took a class at K-State about fantasy and fiction, and we read three versions of King Arthur stories, and that wasn't one of them. So I'll have to pick that one up.
I just wanted to thank you, Molly, the way you wove your life story in with your books, the way you shared the stage with Dave, the way you matched the flowers. It was all like a one-act play, so thank you very much. I will remember this. And my question is, what was the first book you remember reacting to as a child, and what were your favorite preteen books when you were a child?
I, like my grandmother, was a huge fan of The Boxcar Children. But the first book, so that I would say that's probably the one with human characters I most remember. The first book I ever read was actually just called Wolf, and I've actually looked for a copy to see if I can get it for Nick, and I guess it must not be a very popular book, but it was in my local library in Nickerson where I grew up. And it was about a wolf pack and some cubs that were born to them, and how the whole pack took care of the cubs, and they each had their different personalities, and I just remember reading that over and over again when I was 7 and 8 years old. I've been a rereader my whole life. I don't just read a book once and let it go. If I really like it, I read it again and again.
Molly?
Yeah.
Am I on here? Wanted to comment on a couple of things. One, your talk was marvelously well organized. For something that may not have been rehearsed, it was still very well organized.
I committed to doing it 3 months ago. So, okay, there was thought.
Well,
there
you had a wonderful conception behind it. And it's a model, I think, for how people can present talks like this. And often, even my graduate students, I thought, you know, their main problem is they don't organize. And you did a wonderful job. when I came to the topic of books, I wanted to go in a different direction. As we were raising our three children, we were spoiled by our first child, Karen, who just seemed to do everything easily and well. Was an early reader, an avid reader, and we really never had any serious problems with her. And then we had a great awakening when our son David was born, because he was everything Karen wasn't. We were quite worried about him, especially when he got into middle school and high school and started, we thought, running with the wrong gang, with the wrong kinds of other boys. We weren't, and he had problems reading, and we were very worried about that. Until we found out that away from school and away from even our awareness, he was deeply into Dungeons and Dragons type of books and games, too. These elaborate games based on reading the books about them. And at that point, I decided, I think he may work out all right after all, just not the way we had thought. And, you know, there's more than one way that books can affect people. And it isn't always through the school books. And that's what I learned through his experience while watching him. And he's worked out pretty well in the end.
I was going to say, do we need to block that comment from the what goes online?
No, okay, I don't think good. So. No, I mean, he's worked out fine. It's just a different direction. So that's my point, is that sometimes things don't go the way you expect, the way that teachers might expect. And I spent my career being a college teacher. And there's, you know, we try and channel students, but students sometimes channel themselves. And maybe that's the best learning experience for a teacher.
Uh-oh, here comes our librarian.
My grandmother was denied the opportunity to become a school teacher, which she regretted all of her life. Mm-hmm. And she asked that each of her seven living children become school teachers. Five did, including my father, but not for long. I grew up being an instinctive reader, and the elementary school aunts tended to provide me with all kinds of reading material. I was judged in my family to be worthless because I was a reader and I did not want to participate in heavy farm labor. I overheard an aunt saying to my mother one day, that Bryce is not going to amount to anything. He's such a lazy boy. Well, I think I read all the wrong things, though, because when I was 17, I was selected to take the tests for the Summerfield Scholarship at KU. At least my teachers recognized that I was smarter than some of the rest. But it was the biggest humiliation of my life, because when I took the literature section of the test, it was like today's ACTs, I suppose, which didn't exist at the time, and all of the questions were about classical literature. I knew nothing. I had not read any of it, and I can imagine it was a kind of a test written by a college English teacher, of which we all know plenty of now, and it was a humiliation, and I've spent the rest of my life trying to become an educated person, but I still haven't read all the classics.
You seem pretty smart to me.
I've got the microphone. One thing that Kathy pointed out, and I think Christopher mentioned it as well, very important of having a mentor to guide you in the right direction. And I was thinking back to, I think Jennifer asked what was the first book you had read, or what was the first series. And my dad was stationed in Germany when I was a kid. And I remember I was in fifth grade. We lived out in a small German village. We'd go to the library at the closest little army base about once a week to pick up books. And I'd pick up things like, you know, 50 card tricks that you can learn at home, and, you know, how to make your older sister disappear and things like that. You know, all magic-oriented stuff. And my mentor at that time was the little base librarian who said, here, you keep checking out these magic books. Why don't you try this? And I think it was Old Yeller she gave me. And I took it home and thought, this was pretty good. And, you know, the rest is history. You know, Sybil can contest now or attest now to how much I read. And it was the idea of having somebody pointing you in the right direction, which I really appreciate.
Kathleen Tanona, I just love the idea of reading books as scripture. It's just a great idea. It's a great way to look at scripture, the word. Mm-hmm. It's a much nicer way to look at it for me. Thanks.
Thank you.
I just wanted to go back to I was a very studious student. I really wanted to do everything just right. So I went back and I read lots of classics. And but then, I just felt a kind of a restlessness. And when I started to just read things just because they looked like they were interesting to me instead of because they were on the book list, all of a sudden I got to read things like Ursula Le Guin's series where there were strong women and alternate societies and Brave New World, which, believe it or not, wasn't on my reading list, in 1984, which wasn't on it either. And I started reading these things that just opened up the world in a completely different path than the one that was supposed to be laid out in front of me. And the one that I remember most, though, was picking up Dandelion Wine by Ray Bradbury. And all of a sudden, I'm reading this book going, this writing is beautiful. I can just see these. Boy, and every time since that I have tried on tennis shoes at a store, I think of Ray Bradbury. Because if any of you have read Dandelion Wine, there's a great little short story in there about him going to get the first new tennis shoes of summer, which was the hallmark of summer to him. And he's so convincing about the beauty and lightness of these shoes that the shopkeeper puts on, who has never worn a pair of tennis shoes, puts them on, and he closes up the shop, and the two go tripping merrily down the sidewalk.
Another library.
I work at the children's room in the public library. My name is Jessica Long. And just like you guys were saying, I think we need to give kids more freedom to choose what they read. You were talking about how they read in class and that those books may not reach them. And we see that too, but not necessarily with teachers, but a lot of times with parents, because the kids will come in and they have a book they're excited about, and I want to get this book, and the mom looks at it and says, no, you shouldn't read that. Don't read that. Read this instead. And I think a lot of times the kids don't hear, don't read that. They just hear, don't read, because we're not letting them read the books they want. And so, of course, we need to give them lots of opportunities to read good books, but if we want them to become readers, we have to let them read books that they like. And I think we have a hard time with that in school. When I was in children's literature at K-State, the instructor asked, how many of you read for pleasure? Out of a class of nearly 30, three of us raised our hands. And I thought that was really depressing, that so few kids, or college kids, read for pleasure. And when I used to work at the Fort Riley Library, we saw the same thing. The soldiers would have to come and check in with us before they could deploy or before they could get out of the Army. And I don't know how many soldiers were so proud of the fact that I ain't read a book since I was in school. And I'm like, and you're proud of that. And that just saddened me every time they said it. So I think we just need to let kids have books they like, as well as the good ones.
Got recombined, or just I'll take that as
well.
A compliment.
I just want to remind everybody that this week is Banned Books Week. Yeah, I think this is very appropriate. I mean, today starts Banned Book Week, folks. Take a book that's banned and read it. This is the week to just say no to all of this craziness about not reading books. It's the week to read them.
Well, Matt shared with me before, Matt Sayer in the back room, shared with me that he just read an opinion piece about people using various sources to inspire them or define their spirituality in any way. And the opinion piece was basically, get on the bandwagon with Christianity or become a humanist, and there shouldn't be anything in between, and anything else in between is just a cop-out. So I'm your cop-out for the day, I guess, because I've done all the thinking I can do, and this is it. Okay, let's sing our hymn, number 131, Stand As You Are Able. Love will guide us. We are again a cappella, so we have the lovely voices of our men. Closing words are short. What stories can you tell those you care about so that they can better understand you, better understand how you are inspired and how you make choices? Share these stories and consume the same media when you can. It will bring you closer. Thank you.